Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Robert Yeager and the Tau Foundation.
Welcome, welcome. This should be, I like to think most of our shows, if not all of our shows, are wonderful adventures of some kind or another. This time we are going to take a wonderful adventure into the life of another person, and we're going to talk about the way that story is told, an unusual way of telling the story, and maybe an unusual way of using the podcast form. We spent a lot of time thinking and talking about podcasts here, but Jessica Harper, a well-known actress, has used the podcast to create a memoir, which I think is a fairly unusual use of the podcast form, and her use, her particular way of approaching this, I think, is also wonderfully idiosyncratic. We should say Jessica Harper is an actress, author, songwriter. She essentially is doing all of those things as the creator and host of the memoir as podcast that is known as Winnetka. So, Jessica Harper, great to talk to you.
Thanks so much for having me, Colin.
I should say that we have sort of a personal connection. I guess my college classmate is your brother-in-law?
Brother-in-law, yeah. Scott Sherman.
Yeah. When he first started mentioning Jessica Harper, I said, wait, my Jessica Harper? My Jessica Harper? You know my Jessica Harper? I'm in particular a big fan of My Favorite Year, where you are the ingenue. We should say that Mark Lynn Baker has also been on this show. So,
oh, that's fine.
Since
yeah.
Peter O'Toole is gone, we have all we're going to ever get out of My Favorite Year.
Yeah.
So I want to begin first with this story of your family. And having written a memoir myself, I know that there are complicated choices that you have to make, particularly if there are stories that have never been told before. There seem to be a lot of stories to tell. So maybe begin with just what's the impulse? What's the impulse to just let all this stuff hang out there?
Well, that's a really good question. Like, why does anybody write memoir? It was suggested to me, actually, that I do a podcast. I was working for an online magazine called Purple Clover, and they wanted me to do a podcast for them. And they suggested I do it about my family. And I thought, how could that possibly interest anybody? But then I talked to my husband about it, and he said, oh, no, he knows my crazy family quite well. And he said, no, this would be very interesting. And I think the truth is, like, I think actually every family has an interesting story. I absolutely believe that. It's a question of locating that story and telling it in a way that's compelling. So I sat down and thought about it, and after a few months, I found more than one thread that I found really intriguing in my own family story. And as I say, I do have some very interesting characters in my group. There are six kids in this Harper family. And a couple of parents who are unusual, and so I thought I could actually do this. And the reason anybody wants to do a memoir is I'm not really sure why, because there's so many. It's a minefield, obviously. And you have to be very careful, and you have to balance the truth with what your family will tolerate, those who are still alive. And so it is a very strong impulse to tell your story, and I can't really answer why anyone would possibly undertake it, except that I was really compelled to do so.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons that memoirists do this is to teach themselves something. You know, I feel as though when you're working on a memoir, it's kind of like, as you look at everything that constitutes your past, and some of it is stuff that you knew and you just lived with for a really long time and it didn't seem all that strange. I'm an only child, so I couldn't really cross-check things the way that you've been able to do with your siblings. But there are other things that you kind of pull out of somebody, or you read a letter that you've never seen before.
Yes.
And it's like a Stephen King novel or something, except it's your life.
A really gnarly Stephen King novel. Yeah, No, there is absolutely that. There is the impulse to learn more about your family. I learned a great deal from doing the project, and it took me 3 years to do this podcast. And during that time, I did get to know a lot about myself, my relationship with my siblings, their relationships with each other, and above all about my parents. And what was most interesting also, I had you didn't, but I had the benefit of having five siblings to bounce this off and off of. And I learned that, you know, it gets even more complex and interesting and possibly confusing because people do remember things differently.
Yes, yes. And you actually use a joke at one point, a joke that your father used to tell all the time, and you have all of your siblings in this kind of Rashomon-like sequence,
yes, exactly,
try to tell the joke, and nobody can tell the joke the same way.
Right.
We're going to play a clip in just a second, but before I forget to bring this up, I think another thing that's interesting about this project is it takes us back to a time when people thought about child rearing differently than they do now, and that, you know, we always talk about, all of us from the same generation talk about how there wasn't some kind of organized soccer league with uniforms. You just, you know, went out and found some friends and wandered around the neighborhood and did whatever you were going to do. But there's a way in which, I mean, one of the stories that sticks in my mind is that your younger sister at age 7, I think, was just left to her own devices to get home from school just because there were a lot of kids, and also because parents didn't really think, well, who's going to take Lindsay? You know, I mean, it was Lindsay's problem.
Right.
She got, I'm laughing, it's not a thing to laugh, but she did get kidnapped, basically, right?
She did, yeah. Actually, she was only in kindergarten. She was like five or six. Yeah,
smaller than
and
you.
She, yeah, because there were six kids in the family, the youngest of whom were a set of boy twins. So my mother was, needless to say, preoccupied. And so poor Lindsay kind of fell between the cracks and had to walk herself to kindergarten five or six blocks to and fro. And what would you do? Well, this lady comes up to her and says, "Hi, honey, your mother said I could give you a ride home, and we're going to go to the toy store on the way home, and I'll buy you a toy." Well, that, duh, okay, get in the car. You know, you would, unless you had been really strictly informed that that was not a good idea. So she did.
Yeah.
And the outcome was, I should warn people or advise people, the outcome actually was okay. But it was a time when things were pretty loose as far as that was concerned.
Right. It's one of those stories which does have a very benign outcome, but also the hint, the possibility, the kind of multiverse possibility of a far less benign and much darker outcome. And actually, it's interesting, too, because you were first time I think I ever saw you was in Stardust Memories, the Woody Allen movie. And Woody Allen, when he was a stand-up comedian, used to, for a while, he ended his act by saying something that his mother used to say to him when he was growing up, which is, you know, if you're ever walking down the street and this man in a black car comes up and he gets out and he tells you to go with him and that he'll give you all the candy and presents that you want, go. I think we should play a clip. This will give us one of the nice things about this is that your family, including your mom, seem to be willing to have some of these conversations with you. So we're going to hear a little bit of you and your mom from episode 6.
Some months ago, my mother gave me an article that she'd found from the 1950s that offered tips to women on the proper way to welcome your man at home after a hard day's work. She read me those guidelines, and her comments on them revealed that she had fooled us all. While back in the day she had seemed to be that era's model of a perfect housewife, she was actually downright subversive.
Prepare yourself. Take 15 minutes to rest so you will be refreshed when he arrives. Meanwhile, the kids are throwing their blocks out the window. His boring day, well, if he's so bored, he should change jobs. Probably needs to live. Prepare the children. Make sure you have just one. Be happy to see him. Greet him with a smile and be glad to see him. One more mouth to feed. Have dinner. Have dinner ready. He doesn't care a thing about dinner. He wants his drink. Most men are hungry when they come home. Here you are, meatloaf, mashed potatoes. Stuff it down, because I worked hard on it.
So your mom really is kind of a hoot.
She is, yeah.
But there's also a sense in which you guys, your mom and you and your five siblings, are sort of the settlers in the covered wagons drawn into a circle and riding around the outside of you on a horse shooting his pistol into the air is your dad. Your dad is at times scary and violent, and maybe even some of the stories that you guys got used to land with listeners with an even deeper thud.
Mm-hmm. I think that's probably right. Well, he was, he came out of World War II, as did almost all men of his generation, or certainly an awful lot of them. And he was of that generation, the greatest generation, where the expectation was that you would celebrate this glorious accomplishment, which was the winning of World War II, and move right on to join the economic boom that was happening then. Get married, put on your fedora and grab your briefcase and get on that train, commute to your job and start having babies. And there was no pause to process what they had been through, nor any acknowledgement that what they had been through was anything more than just a fabulous experience. And of course, all of them had traumatic experiences during the war. My father was in the South Pacific. One story that I tell, or that my brother tells in the podcast, is about how he was in a foxhole with his buddies, and then he went out to go pee over in the woods, came back, and a shell had gone into the foxhole and blown up all his buddies. I mean, those kinds of things, as we know, happened all the time. So these men came back from the war and, again, were just thrust into good times in America without any discussion or any consideration of what was not called at the time PTSD, or and my mother says he had PTSD, and that he was therefore enraged a lot of the times. He would have these unpredictable fits of rage, and which impacted our lives a lot. But, you know, in retrospect, of course, and again, having done this project and worked on it for so long, there's lots of room for empathy here. On the part of all of us. But when you're a small child, obviously that doesn't occur to you. It's just kind of like, who is this scary person?
Right. He does seem scary, and he hits his children, and he hits children who are considerably younger than we usually think is acceptable, if you think it's acceptable at all to hit children. But there's this scene, and I'm not going to say what it is because I don't want to wreck things for people who listen to Winnetka. But there's a scene where one of your siblings stands up to him, or a little bit anyway, and he kind of cracks. And, you know, there's that Rilke line about how every dragon contains a princess wanting to be saved, that everything ferocious and frightening and dangerous contains something helpless, wanting us to save it. And that's there in that moment. Suddenly, you know, and we're sort of quite a few episodes in at this point, we see this person that way for the first time. He's not just this slapping machine. He's got his own vulnerabilities.
Yes, he does. And he was greatly impacted, as we talk about extensively in the podcast, by his own father, who was the same kind of person, very, very tough, but also, as you say, had this inner, this vulnerability that he also is also exposed during the course. So it's, you know, one generation to the next passes these things down. One of the threads that I found most interesting when I was exploring this was how it is our responsibility as we go along to try and make corrections to these things that are passed down generationally. In my case, it was not only the way fathers treat their children, but also there's a threat of racism in our family that is, I don't think I'll say more because you haven't heard the last three episodes yet.
Right. So I'm just letting the apparently Jonathan McNichol find a way to listen to everything. I'm just letting them drop onto my iPhone feed.
Good for you.
So I'm on episode 7 here, and I know there's some big reveals to come. Just so people can get a little bit more of a flavor. And I think one of the fun things about the podcast is also getting to know some of your other family members. We're going to hear, I think, two of your brothers. This is an episode that I have actually not heard yet, but there's a little clip here from episode 8.
Meanwhile, things were going less well back in Greenwich, Connecticut. My younger siblings were having much less fun than I. Sam and Charlie were installed in an all-boys school.
We went to the school called Brunswick, which is, I think, a very prestigious school, but it was back then it was like a Dickens novel. Charlie had to lie in the hallway and the upperclassmen were instructed to walk over him, walk on him as they went down the hallway.
What was that for?
Talking in class or something.
And so it was. We were stepped on time and time again, physically and emotionally, by this very abusive school, Brunswick.
I think he got caught shooting a spitball. Big pen, in those days, you could take the ink cartridge out and make a really good pea shooter, and you'd shoot the spitballs with the big pen. And he got caught doing that, so the teacher made him put the big pen on the floor and roll it out of the classroom with his nose. I mean, I don't know how they thought that stuff up.
So I want to, first of all, yeah, these guys are a lot of fun. I mean, they're a little scary in their own right sometimes when they're turning into a Winnetka crime wave. They manage to create an awful lot of mayhem and chaos around them when they're not being controlled by the Brunswick School. I wanted to ask you, though, I was going to ask you this a little bit later, but since it's there right at the top of the clip, I'm interested to know how you, as a performer, You do everything on this podcast. You write it, you narrate it, or you do more than really narrate it. You do the Geico commercials. You write music. You perform the music. I mean, it really is quite a tour de force. But, you know, there's a way in which, and I listen to a lot of podcasts, mm-hmm. You're doing something that I typically don't hear, which is a lot of your delivery is kind of a husky whisper. There's a sense in which, you know, sometimes I listen to podcasts before I go to bed, and there's mm-hmm. Jessica Harper is suddenly kind of confiding in me. I don't know if you did this intentionally or not, but it's an unusual delivery. It is like you're telling me and everybody else a secret.
Yeah. Yes. Well, it's a very, very personal project, and I felt it was important that the delivery express that it was personal. And that what I had to say was really my truth. You know, it was really coming from my insides and into your ear. I wanted, and the nature of the delivery needed to reflect that. I wanted it to be an intimate experience between me and the listener, as I think I love to listen to podcasts that have that quality. And as I say, because I want them to feel how true this is and significant to me, because otherwise, I don't think it will resonate as well with them, with the listener.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. I guess the other thing that I'm curious to know, what every memoirist has to cope with, and you've already alluded to this in our conversation, cope with the question of the remaining people who have vested interests, who are stakeholders in the story. And so did everybody have kind of veto power over anything? Or did you lay down some ground rules in terms of what people were allowed to object to? How did you navigate everybody's interest in telling the story a certain way?
First of all, I ran it by my siblings. Well, I have an older sister who's not really that accessible. She's sort of a little bit disconnected from my world and from the world of most of my siblings. So I had less communication with her about it. And then in that case, I chose to use material that she spoke very sparingly. And she sent me a story, which I think you may have heard in episode 7 about her civil work as a civil rights.
Right.
So, you know, if somebody isn't willing to tell that story in general, I didn't explore it myself. But I didn't get any of that, actually. All my siblings were incredibly generous, willing to tell everything, and very supportive of the result. And, you know, when I spoke to my mother, I was careful to, I wanted her to say, for example, those things about my father that might be disturbing, which she did volunteer. I didn't want that to just be me telling on my father. I wanted my mother's tacit approval by the fact that she was willing to speak about it herself. So I just tried to navigate it that way to make sure that the words came from others in my family, that the story was fully supported in that respect. So that, you know, again, it's not just me telling my side entirely, although, of course, ultimately it is my perspective on things. But I tried as best I could to honor what, you know, their particular viewpoint in telling these stories.
So this podcast derives its title, of course, from Winnetka, Illinois, where you grew up. But although it begins, interestingly enough, the first place that's mentioned, I think, is Old Lyme, Connecticut. So since right. I'm sitting here in Connecticut, tell me about that.
Well, my parents loved Connecticut. They spent the last 30 years of their life in Connecticut. When my father, as you'll hear in episode 8, when he moves the family away from Winnetka, finally, the first place they went was Greenwich, and then they moved into New York. But they had a country house in Kent for a long time, and then, as I say, when he retired in his early 60s, they moved up there eventually full time to Lyme, and so we all spent a great deal of time up there. Hmm. Many of us got Lyme disease, as a matter of fact, and we all loved it. It was beautiful, and unfortunately, when they passed, my father in 13, my mother in 16, we sold the family house up there. So we're not going to be visiting as often, but it was a great place to spend time.
Well, we will miss you. I think we should take a break. We're going to come back. I think people do want to hear about some stuff that's not particularly in the podcast, things about your movie career. So why don't we talk a little bit about that and a little bit more about life in general.
Can I ask you a question? Is it my imagination, or have you been kind of looking at me all night? I mean, tell me if I'm wrong. I don't know.
Does it bother you?
No. I mean, I was just wondering, you know,
I've never seen such a sexy classical violinist before. I mean, usually they're escaped Hungarians.
No, I'm from Winnetka, Illinois.
Are you?
Yeah.
Funny, because you remind me of somebody. It's the strangest thing.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's our guest, Jessica Harper, in Stardust Memories. She plays Daisy. Woody Allen plays Sandy Bates, who's talking to her there. And you get to name check Winnetka, Illinois. I assume that was something that was negotiated.
It was, yeah. He took several things from my life in that script. It's interesting. I remember when he first asked me if I'd liked this role, which was just, I was breathtakingly excited about. And he came to my house and he sort of wandered around the house looking for clues. Because, as you know from his movies, particularly, I guess, Annie Hall, he likes to draw on the actors' actual lives a little bit to inform the characters that he's got them in the movie. So he came to my house and he saw that I had a violin. Mm-hmm. And I pretended that I actually knew how to play the violin, which in fact is not exactly true. But anyway, so he made me a violin player in the movie. And then I wore a lot of my own wardrobe in the movie. And I also was from Winnetka, Illinois in the movie, which I'm now fully outing myself as being from Winnetka, Illinois with this podcast.
Yes, I think you've left no room for doubt about where you're from.
Right.
You mentioned Annie Hall. You actually turned down a part in Annie Hall.
Well, that's true. It was a small role, although some would say there is no such thing. But I was at the very same moment offered a role in an Italian horror movie. Some people might say I made a dubious choice, but that horror movie is called Suspiria, and it's directed by Dario Argento. And it meant going to Italy for 4 months and appearing in this wild movie directed by Dario was considered sort of the Alfred Hitchcock of Italy at the time. And it didn't, it came to the States and went rather quickly away, but over the course of 40 years, it's become an enormous cult movie and is now regarded as one of the top 10 horror movies ever. And so I've been sort of you know, riding on the on the celebrity of this movie. And not only that, but then last year, Luca Guadagnino, the director who some probably know from Call Me By Your Name and many other wonderful movies, made his own Suspiria. I wouldn't even say it's an homage to the other one. He would explain it as the fact that when he was 15, he saw the original Suspiria, and it freaked him out, A, and B, made him resolve that one day he would do his own Suspiria. And he did. So it came out last year, starred Tilda Swinton, Dakota Johnson, and they asked me to do a cameo in it since I had been in the in Dario's version of the movie 40 years before.
So actually, let's hear a little bit of the original Suspiria.
That poor kid ending up like that. I can't even think about it. I heard you saw her yesterday evening.
Uh-huh, outside the school. She was acting very strange. Mumbling to herself.
She really felt terrible when they kicked her out, but she really deserved it.
There was so much noise.
God, was she difficult.
She was saying things that made no sense.
She was always arguing, causing trouble.
Secret. Iris.
What?
I remember she mentioned the word secret. And then she mentioned a flower. The iris, I think, or a lilac.
Secret flowers? What's that supposed to mean?
I don't know.
We should say the other actresses' lines are dubbed because the style here was that everybody acted in their native language, and then the languages were kind of unified depending on which country the film was being released in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we generally, I don't know how it works in Italy now. I haven't worked there in years, but yeah, they shot without real consideration for sound because it was all going to be dubbed later. So there are very, very few scenes in which actually the sound, the original sound was used. I did a lot of looping.
So I think one of the realities of your career, I actually was reading articles about you to get ready for this. There was an article from, an Arizona newspaper that said, cult actress Jessica Harper. And I thought, well, that doesn't really exactly sound right, cult actress Jessica Harper. But it is true that the movies that you've been in are often movies that people have a tremendous passion about, but it'll be about that particular movie. In other words, I'll be honest with you. I don't want to be freaked out. And so I got a little way through Suspiria, and I thought, I'm not going to make it. and so I watched all your other movies. But it does seem as though, you know, people who watch Suspiria will have incredible passion about that. Maybe somebody who's more of a Woody Allen fan will have a passion about that. But one of the nice things is you haven't made very many movies that people aren't passionate about anyway. People tend to really care about these movies.
It's really odd because there are these movies that I've done that, as I say, when they open and they bomb, and then I remember appearing on the Merv Griffin show many, many years ago, a talk show that used to be, and sitting there talking with him, saying, you know, everything I'm in just flops. I don't know what my problem. I probably shouldn't have said that on national television, but it did seem to be kind of a common thing. But then, as you see, people hang on to them. I mean, Suspiria most fiercely, because it is incredible what kind of mail I get from people, and also Phantom of the Paradise is another one that some of your listeners may have heard of, but it also has a huge cult following. Yeah, but on the other hand, there are some that people simply passionately hate, and that's the end of it.
Right. I mean, I think another movie that's in the sort of love it or hate it is Pennies from Heaven. I was actually on a lot of the press tour for that, where Steve Martin and Dennis Potter and some of these other people. Yeah. And you could sort of see that this was going to be an issue.
Yeah.
First of all, Steve Martin was coming off The Jerk, so people thought it was going to be something like that. It was far darker and a little bit more creative in a different way. But it wasn't a movie that resembled a lot of other movies. And people tend to look for things that resemble something that they like. So you could sort of see that. I do want to quickly say that, I mean, my favorite year is one of my favorite movies. It's you and the amazing Peter O'Toole and Mark Lynn Baker, who's from around here, so I kind of know him. And let's just play a little. We should say also that it is the story of a guy who's kind of a lowly person on a working on a 1950s TV show. His job is to get this incredibly out of control actor named Alan Swan to actually not be drunk and not be out of control and to do the stuff that he's supposed to do. He's kind of an Errol Flynn type guy. This young fellow's other problem is that he's in love with this beautiful young woman who doesn't seem to be entirely reciprocating his affections. So let's hear all three of you talking about that.
Eyes. It's always in the eyes.
You. I would like a word with you.
Benjamin, we're in the middle of an interesting conversation here.
Oh, I bet it's real interesting. What's the subject of this interesting conversation?
These eyes. They're Merleau-Biron's eyes.
Merleau-Biron's? Oh, and what's Merle doing for eyes? Using Katharine Hepburn's?
Excuse me, Alan.
Excuse me, Alan.
Benjamin, what is the matter with you?
Me? If you're going to fall for every movie star who comes on the show, what kind of a future are we going to have?
The same as we have now. None.
Wait. Give her a head start. It gives her the illusion she's being chased.
So the premise of the scene is that Peter O'Toole's character, Alan Swan, has turned on his continental charm and got you into kind of a little melty state. My sense watching that movie is that Peter O'Toole himself wasn't really too far from the character that he was playing.
Very close to it. Yeah.
So what was it like having him around? What was it like having that kind of exposure to him?
Oh, my. It was just like, here I am with Lawrence of Arabia, for God's sake. It was so intimidating. He's just that beauty, and even then, when he was older, he was gorgeous, and as his in his character, he would wear smoking jackets, and he would be smoking, and striding around like the movie star that he is, and always hitting the marks, always knowing his lines, and I think somewhat disdainful of the American way of, wait a minute, I need 30 minutes to go and discover my motivation, that kind of disdain for American methods.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like that Laurence Olivier used to say, just know your lines and show up and hit your marks. And I think he, anyway, very, very professional. Although I heard some stories later that would make your
yes.
hair curl, but I don't think I'll talk about them to your lovely audience. In any case, at the time I was very intimidated and thrill of a lifetime to be standing, have him staring into my eyes and calling them Merleau-Biron's eyes.
So Jessica Harper, in the few minutes that we have left here, so there's a big reveal coming up on the podcast, Winnetka. I haven't gotten to it yet. I don't know what it is. But there's also a way in which at the beginning you tease out the full life story of this whole family, and you mention a whole bunch of different things that came to happen, or children out of wedlock, or mention all kinds of stuff. And it makes me think this 10-episode podcast isn't going to contain all that. You have an awful lot of stories to tell that probably extend well beyond wherever episode 10 stops. So is there going to be – do you like this form enough to do more of it?
I love the form. I love doing this, doing audio. And I love the directions that podcasts are going in, and all kinds of audio going into the direction of telling dramatic stories and, long form nonfiction like this is just I find really appealing. Whether I will do it again right away, I don't know. I have two ideas about extending this story or leapfrogging over the next decade maybe and picking it up later in life. So we'll see. I'm working on another project right now and an acting project. We'll see if I can you know, get my thoughts together and make another podcast happen. But I would love to.
I mean, there's a way in which it's got to be satisfying, although also challenging, in that the way that you decided to construct this podcast, it really kind of taps every single thing that you can do. Well, I shouldn't say that because you're also a very accomplished cook, I happen to know, and you do cookbooks, so that wasn't really involved in here. But in terms of your own delivery of this material and essentially directing other people to deliver material, mostly family members, writing material, polishing it, drawing out some of the humor in some otherwise dark and complicated situations, writing and performing music for it. I mean, I always say that it's a good day when at the end of the day you feel as though the world asked you to do all the things that you could do, that it must be a horrible feeling, people who go home and nobody asked them at all to do the things that they know that they're good at. Mm-hmm. So I would imagine there's something kind of enticing about this because you have so much control and so many chances to do things you do well.
That's exactly right. I feel incredibly lucky, too, as you said. Go home at the end of the day having exercised not one passion, but several, all in the course of a day, and doing it under my own auspices, completely in my control. I don't have a boss. It's just lovely. that's a huge part of its appeal. You get to do whatever you want, and you don't have to audition. Even, as you know, to create a podcast, you don't have to. It's not like you have to get a publisher if you're a book writer. You just make the damn podcast. And so having that kind of control and being able to do it every day is really appealing.
Jessica Harper, so great to talk to you. The podcast is called Winnetka, available on podcasting platforms. Thanks to Jonathan McNichol for producing this show today. Thanks to Kion Wolf for running the board. Coming up is Nicholas Kwa, who's going to tell us a little bit about the state of the podcasting industry. I have to tell you, Nick, because there was construction on his street, stepped into the bathroom to talk to me. We recorded this earlier today, and there may be a little bit of a problem hearing him. But bear with us, because he's got some pretty important information. So having talked now to Jessica Harper about Winnetka, her podcast, I thought it would be appropriate, particularly because there's a lot going on right now and he's kind of been covering a lot that's going on, to have Nicholas Kwa, the editor and publisher of Hot Pod, a newsletter, the newsletter, in my opinion, about podcasts. So first of all, welcome back. Good to hear your voice.
My pleasure.
So let's start with what is called the Infinite Dial. This is an Edison research project that looks at the popularity of podcasts, the adoption and downloading of podcasts. Based on your writing about it, I haven't actually looked at the raw figures myself, but it sounds like what podcasts are not doing is plateauing yet. The growth is still there?
Right. If anything, this past year has seen a jump that's been pretty unprecedented. I think Todd Webster, who is one of the main people preparing the report, has sort of mentioned that in his sort of like decade plus long period of covering podcasting, he's never seen a jump in audience numbers like this. And this is across the board. It's across age groups. It's across demographics. It's also across sort of user stickiness. So there have been more Americans who've tried podcasting. There are more Americans who are sticking around, and it seems that this isn't going away anytime soon.
Right. I mean, 51% of Americans reported having listened to a podcast at least once in their lives. I mean, that's not a suggestion of a podcasting habit, obviously, but it is more than half, and more than half feels like something.
Right. It does feel like something. And also, podcast awareness is up to like more than 3/4 of Americans. But the sort of primary metric to take a look at is the sort of monthly listening numbers. And it's currently pegged to about like a third of Americans have listened to a podcast in the past month. And this is largely interpreted to be like they can be sort of roughly thought of as monthly listeners at this point.
And I don't have it in front of me, but I seem to recall from your newsletter that there was a little bit of information about how many podcasts some regular podcast users are listening to. One of the things podcasting needs to do is move beyond, you know, Serial or any other one podcast being the only podcast. You sort of want to see people have a diet of them. Do we know a little bit more about that at this point?
Absolutely. So the study mentioned that the sort of average number of podcasts consumed in a week by sort of Americans who report themselves to be weekly podcast listeners is 7. And it's so that's 7 podcasts on average a week. And this has stayed the same over the past sort of two study periods now. But a notable thing about this is that it stayed the same despite the fact that the overall number of weekly listeners and the overall number of like podcast consumers in America has also increased, which suggests that when Americans like get converted into podcast listeners, they really, really get converted to into a podcast listener.
Right. You say that this moment right here, this Edison study, feels like the end of the era, the kind of maybe the on-ramp era that began in 2014 when Serial came out. People who had never really sought out a podcast sought out a podcast. It feels maybe like we're all the way up the on-ramp and seeing people pour out onto the highway now.
Right. It kind of feels, and we're sort of talking to a lot of like critics about this and a lot of other sort of people who've covered smaller emerging sort of art scenes or creative scenes. It really does feel like one of those things where like a small indie scene is beginning to sort of show like traction. And I feel like over the next year, two, 3 years, we're going to see sort of the real influx of big business. And it, you know, and it's sort of, it's going to push this medium and this community into sort of a realm that's never been before, and we're going to have to sort of ask a lot of questions about, you know, who is a part of this community and how business gets started here and sort of how we should think about the medium moving forward.
So that's a good transition to one of the other big pieces of news. You've been tracking this for a really long time. Most people don't know about it yet. It's something called Luminary. It is typically referred to as the Netflix of podcasts. So tell us about that.
Right. So Luminary is, it's a sort of up-and-coming, so it's an upcoming podcast platform that's supposed to be, primarily to provide paid exclusive podcasts. And so they're really, really sticking and doubling down on this Netflix analogy. And it should be noted that this isn't the first time that a company has tried this before, most notably Stitcher, which is one of the bigger podcast publishers and sort of advertising networks. They have an app called Stitcher Premium that sort of dabbles in exclusive content. This is a really, really big play. This company has raised $100 million to essentially build out a portfolio of podcasts that they're sort of betting people will want to pay $8 a month for. And this is it's a lot of money. We haven't seen this much money spent on a sort of strategy like this before. But it's also caused a little bit of rift in the community because it does like the sort of closed paid nature of it challenges one of the sort of core ideological tenets of podcasting, which is it's supposed to be free, it's supposed to be open, and it's supposed to be accessible by everybody and anybody's able to sort of publish something into the podcast ecosystem. So on the one hand, you have this sort of really pivotal, interesting moment in the business of podcasting, but you also have something a bit of like an identity crisis. It's a conflict point for sure.
Right. And I think that's a great point. But one of the ways that they've dealt with that is to really, you know, they've rounded up some of the really big names, people whose work you do want to continue to hear, whether that's Adam Davidson, who's a good friend of our show, Guy Raz, Slow Burns, Leon Neyfakh. I mean, I'll pay $8 a month not to miss what Leon Neyfakh does next, Jacob Weisberg, Malcolm Gladwell, Lena Dunham. I mean, these are Alex Gibney. These are people whose work you really do want to hear. And if there's some kind of threshold you have to get over to be willing to pay $8 a month, I would say for a lot of people like me anyway, are really going to want to do this.
So I agree. Like, I also really want to like listen to what Leon Neyfakh does next. I'm really curious to hear what Jacob Weisberg and Malcolm Gladwell's next project is. There are a number of names in that original roster that sort of is really interesting to me, and I will, even if I wasn't covering this space, I would probably pay $8 to check it out. The question is sort of like, will I stay paying $8 after the first 2 months, right? A lot of these publishers, these big name publishers that they've signed projects with, aren't exactly like exclusive. Like, for example, Guy Raz has three or four other podcasts that exists everywhere else, and sort of, will I really want to pay $8 for his fourth project? Am I like a super Guy Raz fan? And it's also a situation in which, like, once I've gone through, you know, Leon Neyfakh's season, Malcolm Gladwell's new season, or whatever he does, will there be enough for me to stick around? And that's really the sort of game here. And it's also, you know, it's can they build a supply chain that can really control sort of a momentum of excitement for the consumer, for the listener, and can they sort of actually make this a viable business? $100 million, again, is a ton of money that's raised, and I imagine that they have really, really specific and strict sort of benchmark they must hit over a specific timeline. So it, to me, it feels like a huge high-risk, high-wire act. But at the very least, some publishers are going to get paid pretty well for this.
Right. So one of the things that this would do away with is, and it's kind of interesting, podcasting being such a new medium, in a way it resembles the older kind of radio, the pre-this radio. I worked in commercial radio for a really long time, and I used to do ads. I used to do, they were called live reads, and, you know, I would do them. I'd put them in my own words, my own voice. And this happens a lot. I mean, we were just talking to Jessica Harper about Winnetka. Well, I mean, in the middle of what she's doing, she'll suddenly do a Geico ad. And, you know, some of the podcasters are really kind of good at this. I mean, Mike Pesca can transition pretty easily into doing an ad. But people often are trying to run away from advertising these days. And I guess that's one of the big arguments for Luminary, right, that you don't have to deal with ads.
Well, I mean, that's one version of the argument. I've always found that sort of like, I think the reality here is that people aren't running away from ads. They're running away from like bad ads. And I think the reality is the majority of advertising experiences in our daily life, whether it's television or a billboard, or if you go to South by one of those brand activations that kind of hit you in the face, it's really assaulting and it's really sort of oppressive. And the thing about podcasting and its particular sort of interpretation of advertising is that it's been able to provide an experience that does feel, you know, intimate and authentic to a lot of listeners, and has been able to show like real value to advertisers over time, while balancing sort of a dignity and a respect to the listener. So to a large extent, Luminary trying to solve a problem that isn't really a problem. Mm-hmm. But and I would argue that there are many other problems that they are very, very well suited to solving. One example of this is the fact that it's really hard to make a highly produced, resource-intensive 8-episode project and have that be adequately financed by advertising, because just the way advertising works, it kind of privileges shows that are ongoing. And so Luminary is in a position to help shows like that. But I can't tell from the outset whether they see that lane as a viable one.
So let's talk about the third and final topic that I wanted to bring up with you and Nikwa. It's something else that Hot Pod has been covering. I think Caroline Crampton, your partner at Hot Pod, has been writing about this a lot. And that is the notion of podcaster burnout. There are an awful lot of people who do podcasts in addition to something else that's kind of their main gig. There are a lot of, it seems at the beginning, maybe like this will fit pretty easily into somebody's workload. But what are you guys beginning to see about this?
We're beginning to see. So it's one of the really interesting sort of feedback we've gotten is from a lot of readers who are in parallel industries, whether they are journalists or filmmakers or writers. They kind of made the argument that if you swap out podcasts with any other creative medium, you have like pretty much the same story. Mm-hmm. But it does feel like podcasting is hitting this moment where it used to be this sort of labor of love, where there isn't sort of the attraction of of doing this for a ton of money or being validated, with successful sort of like write-ups or coverage in press and whatever. And so you have this situation in which there's a generation of these hobbyists, all the way up to professional creators, who are sort of experiencing a shift in expectations. And as they do this longer and sort of, you know, continue to spill blood and sweat over the work, that they are beginning to sort of really question why they're doing this. And it's really, really taxing, because podcasting is in between this place where it's figured the business side out and it's figured out other parts of getting in front of people and all that and building systems of recognition. But we're not quite there yet. And as a result, a lot of podcasters, I think, right now are moving forward and feeling that they are working and they're not seeing a ton coming back for the things that they're working on.
Right. I mean, a lot of it depends on what you thought was going to happen in the first place. If you thought that you were going to put this stuff on the air, put your work on the air, or not on the air, but in the podcasting platforms, and get discovered and get paid a lot of money.
Right.
I mean, there's some people who just like, you know, they want to do a Game of Thrones podcast, and they don't even care that there's, I don't know how many, you know, there's 70 other Game of Thrones podcast that'll be competing for the same audience starting in April, if not sooner. They just want to do it, you know. And for those people, I suppose it's probably relatively easy to drop it too if it becomes a huge pain in the neck.
Absolutely. I mean, it's kind of an age old question of you know, a creative or art project or a project of sort of expression isn't necessarily a good business. Mm-hmm. And the sort of tension there often leads to, you know, the sort of roots of these burnouts, I think.
Yeah. Well, we'll monitor that, and we hope there's not too much burnout. Nicholas Kwa, editor and publisher of Hot Pod, a newsletter about podcasts. Thanks for joining me today.
Always a pleasure.
All right. And that wraps up our show today, too. We hope you enjoyed it. I'll be interested to hear if you seek out Winnetka, Jessica Harper's new memoir podcast.